Hello, hello. Welcome to the episode on Where Reasons End by Yoon Lee. This book came out on February 5th of this year, and it's actually my first book review, and I'm so excited to share this project with y'all. I worked really hard on it, and it's going to be really great. Hello and welcome back to Diddy and Hawthorne in the In-Between. I'm your host, Mackenzie Gentz, and you're listening to my podcast about the relevancy of literature in the 21st century. Now bookmark that book and let's begin. So the concept for this project was actually that I wrote diary entries of sorts while I was reading the book, and this is quite unusual for me because I usually read the book and then wait a couple days to process and then write an episode on it. This time I was writing just these passages while I was going through the book, and it was interesting because I didn't get the sense of finality and the sense that I had processed quite everything that was said until the very end of the book. So it was just a really weird experiment and a weird process for me. But anywho, the actual making of the episode was I went around my college campus and I got other people to read the diary entries that I wrote to symbolize a bunch of different inner voices. And I think that, especially in the context of a book review, that this was the right thing, at least for this book, to do. That is to say also that some of the audio quality isn't the best and that there might be background noise at points, but I really did try to edit everything as concisely and as beautifully as possible for you. So I hope you enjoy this quite unconventional episode of DH&I.
Page 1. The novel starts out with a free-form Elizabeth Bishop poem called Argument, about the motifs of days and distance. The title appears in the second stanza. On further research, I've discovered that Bishop was a 50s-era American poet. Am I just imagining remembering that she was a prominent feminist? Fact check later.
Page 4. We've been chatting about which identities individuals choose to index in speech, and the Bishop poem has me at ends whether she is indexing gender or something like motherhood or ethnicity first. I love this mother-son relationship that she establishes right off the cusp. Her writing will take some getting used to, but it's quite similar to other Asian authors, namely Murakami and Ishiguro. Very bare bones, very obscure.
Page 6. Getting into it more, the prose is like a mix of Margaret Atwood and Joan Didion. I don't say this as a comparison or an oversimplification, only as an explanation for my brain, which must subsist off of previous knowledge as fact. Atwood, because she focuses on words a ton, which I love, their definitions rather, and she also meditates on them, feeling for their various forms and contexts. Didion, because I have rooted that this novel is about grief and its circularity, and the question of how does one even begin to articulate something so traumatizing.
Page 9. Do not let Mother Dear find us. And some are tomorrow and some are today, never some are yesterday, is an entrancing motif of the book. 9 pages in, and I'm confused, yet riveted.
Page 19. Time is not only the place where we live. Okay, so I've adjusted the prose and found out that she is imagining and perhaps remembering scenes and conversations with her dead son, equating the deafness and blindness of those images to her feelings of loss. The imagery here is astounding, especially since the prose is so bare and minimal. The book was originally written in English, too, a startlingly beautiful English that strikes me like a freshly tied bow on hair.
Page 30. It should be no secret that I read before bedtime. I had to get out of bed and turn my laptop on to write this. To love is a trespass. To live too, he said. How can anyone not see it that way? I wish, in a silly sort of way, that such words were immortalized somewhere more tangible, more immediate than the novel itself. On a wall or written by way of flowers in the garden, perhaps. I got out of bed for this.
Page 38. One does, when reading, get the sense that the plot is moving indefinitely forward, even though it is not, in fact, moving forward at all. The dialogue between mother and son is intimate and crafted in a way that makes the reader feel as if they have somehow entered a private bubble, heard through a locked door, read a personal letter of someone that should be cared about, but in what way, that is yet unknown.
I think also that part of my ability to disassociate, or rather associate more deeply, I'm not quite sure which, with the text and the fact of its irreversibly morbid plot, is that I'm quite comfortable with the issue of mortality. I understand in my limited living sort of way that we must all die, and I'm therefore intrigued rather than disturbed when faced with discussions of loss and death.
Page 38. I was listening to a TED talk earlier that noted that the death of a spouse is the most traumatic experience that one can have. I disagree. The death of a child surely has to be at least more traumatic than the spouse. I mean, think about it. The phenomenon is so unnatural that we don't even have a word for it. We have widow, we have orphan, we have an abyss for childless parent.
Page 46. It strikes me now that she does the McCarthy thing with dialogue, where most of it occurs without indications of who is speaking and also without quotes around it. If you don't know what I'm talking about, by the way, check out bonus episode 1 called McCarthy and I, where I discuss the highly disturbing Child of God, among other things.
Page 48. Then we became catchers in the rain. Catchers of words and metaphors and all of the things that mother and son will never share again. This page reminds me of a rainy April when the rains wash everything away and the slate is wiped clean for the new beginning that only the birds take advantage of.
Page 58. Writing about grief, and subsequently reading about it, is extremely tiring because it is so cyclic in nature. The grief is omnipresent, and so is the sorrow. I'm still thinking about a quote from a few pages ago that articulated something like, those who can read can feel, and those who write cannot feel, but write in an expression of their want of feeling. Therefore, different periods in one's life are for reading and writing respectively. This is one of those instances where I don't know if I quite agree with the author. I'll get back to you when I'm done with the novel.
Page 58.
Dream diaries are super interesting, but they have begun to freak me out. I kept one for a period of months once, and I dreamed so often that it filled up rather quickly with the weirdest scenarios possible, but I remember feeling disturbed when I didn't dream, and also remember having dreams linger with me for longer than they needed to. I think that at their roots, dreams are for processing and filtering the information that you encounter or ponder during the daytime, and that after they are over, they should stay in their graves, so to speak. Perhaps over time, our perspective on dreams will change. However, I don't really know.
Page 67. Poems without themes has such a neat sound to it. I'm not talking about the meaning of the phrase, just the sound of it. Poems without themes.
Page 72. How do we, as people, as sons and daughters and parents and teachers and friends, ride the line between blase and overzealous? Is it better to live and appreciate every day as its own masterpiece without much variation, or drown in mundanity only to overcompensate during holidays? Is there such a thing as an in-between?
Page 73. I love the word repose. She uses it here sparingly, asking if our hearts may ever find repose after a great loss. I think that oftentimes people fake repose or mask pain with hollow joy after great loss. Loss is in our lives because life becomes a spectrum that way, of the loved and lost and the in-between, always circling between thorns and beautiful regret.
Page 90. Trees seem to me to be the ultimate metaphor. I'm endlessly thinking about the lifespan of trees and their roles in our lives. There's also a Trees of Northwestern Instapage that I've heard is pretty good during the fall.
Page 94. But if you have a life, do you understand what a life is? Do you know what to do with it? For me, the obvious answer to this is religion. Life is meant to be lived for it, by it, and through it. I'm curious about others' philosophies, though. What is it like to spend one's whole life trying to define the days that have been miraculously given to you? Very sorry for the ensuing existential crises.
Page 98. Death is a divide no matter how little you and I believe its power to separate. Sometimes I find myself stopping and reading sentences like this one over and over, pining for the meaning and inherent suffering beyond the inherent meaning and inherent suffering. My daily exercise is regular as coffee and as black as the bottom of the cup.
End. Turns out that I read the last 70 pages in one sitting without writing any entries, so I'm going to muse on what I thought about the book as a whole now. It's quite small, and it's by no means a book with the difficulties of a Tolstoy or Didion book to get through at least, but it packs a powerful punch. I love the Alice in Wonderland recurring metaphor, and I love how Lee was able to funnel regret and loss into something quite exquisite. End. The Elizabeth Bishop stuff was right. I was afraid at the time that I was getting her mixed up with Edna Vincent Millay, whose collected sonnets I'm currently tackling. End. I think that a lot of the conclusions that she draws about writing, such as the one claiming that writers essentially don't feel, have a surface truth that makes such comments enjoyable to muse over. As I've thought over them deeper, however, I do feel that writers sell themselves and their feelings short quite consistently, and I would argue that in order to articulate the unfelt or unseen, they would perhaps have to be more feeling or otherwise more intuitive about certain feelings than the rest of us. There's a long history of writers who turn to alcohol or otherwise are abusers because of the dichotomy between self-proclaimed lacking and the actual overflowing of feeling. End. My last thought for y'all is that perhaps we are not taught how to feel in this world, but rather what to feel. Peace.
If you enjoyed the discussion and would like to hear more from me, there's an episode of DH&I for everyone, so I recommend checking out our back catalog of episodes. 2019 is the year of Didion, so if you'd like to follow along in my quest to read Joan Didion's collective works or learn more about the movement to bring lit back to people, everything can be found at didionandhawthorne.blueberry.net, and remember that blueberry is spelled B-L-U-B-R-R-Y. Now you can also follow the show on Twitter with @DidionIn, 2 N's total. I'll be posting about new lit releases, reading lists, and of course our new projects and episodes relating to DH&I, including most recently the Love of February series and our April in Paris series in April. Also, stay tuned for the next episode. This next one is going to be a surprise, so it is coming out on the first week of March. We'll see what it is.
Still there? One more thing then. Remember that leaving a comment or review on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, or any other Guilty Pleasure podcast platform helps leverage the show so that other literature enthusiasts can find the community. In other words, it helps a ton. Auf Wiederhören!